escalation between Damascus and Washington, yet Shia throws in this option only due to confusion at Said Nasrallah's announcement. It does not end here. During her call with the president, U.S. Ambassador Shia pointed out that the American side is making a great effort to help Lebanon and that negotiations are underway with the World Bank to secure financing for Egyptian gas for Lebanon to repair and strengthen electricity transmission lines and the required maintenance of gas pipelines, which are again located inside Syria. I just have one question here. Who delegated Shia to do all of these issues? And then she has the audacity to call the Lebanese president and tell him what solutions he should be accepting or refusing while his nation suffers the most severe economic crisis since its independence? Wow. Just wow. It is astonishing how she has suddenly contrived high morals and dedication to help Lebanon. Her intentions are crystal clear, but it's too late. Nothing will be able to block the way for Hezbollah's effort to rid its people from humiliation and despair. The first Iranian fuel ship is on its way, and several others will only follow very soon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A ship for oil derivatives is headed to Lebanon from Iran, but its arrival in Lebanon will go beyond improving the conditions of the Lebanese. It will be the first ship to ever break the fuel blockade and will establish a new deterrence equation at sea this time. Lebanon's enemies are aware of its urgent need for energy. They stand behind a large part of its crisis, whether through sieges and sanctions or through obstruction and obstacles to solutions by proxy. The Lebanese crisis is no longer bearable. When hospitals in Lebanon stop working due to the loss of electricity and the lives of the Lebanese are at risk, and when a number of them die while in queues in front of the gas stations, and when bakeries operate at minimum capacity, intervention to help becomes a national duty, even a moral imperative. This is exactly what Hezbollah did. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maarouf, political commentator and senior media consultant. Thank you, Laith, for being with us. Now, some local and a lot of regional media as well considered the Iranian fuel ship on its way to Beirut at the moment as a cluster bomb, which could cause, again, a devastating war, forming a forefront of opposition against this Iranian fuel ship before it even arrives and just intimidating the public with warnings of possible hysterical outcomes. Do they have valid reasons for all of this concern?
Well, definitely it is a possibility that apartheid Israel, the United States, and its vessels in the Gulf will attempt to stop this ship from reaching Lebanon. But it's a very small possibility because we've seen, a few months ago during the Sword of Jerusalem war in Palestine that apartheid Israel can't even take on the small resistance groups located inside Gaza. And as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, has indicated, he said that the ship right now is considered a Lebanese territory and that anyone who will basically attack this ship will receive the same kind of retaliation. So we should be calculating that into what had happened also in the last few weeks in Afghanistan and the humiliating American withdrawal. So it is a very small possibility that apartheid Israel or the United States will open a battle with Hezbollah that they don't even know where it will end. This is, they have avoided a direct war with Hezbollah over the last 10 years, 15 years since the end of the 2006 year war. And it's a very small possibility that they will do such a crazy move.
But something truly dangerous happened after Sayyid Nasrallah's announcement and declaration there, Laith. One local reporter suggested that a return to Resolution 1701 was a must and called for, quote, joint operations rooms, unquote, between the Lebanese army and the United Nations be used to intercept the Iranian ship. This is a call for war there, claiming it threatens the outbreak of war. So certain media outlets are calling for war to supposedly stop an act of war, which does not even make any sense here. Clearly, such calls are the U.S.'s first and foremost demand. I'm not making this up. This is what the ambassador herself is saying. Why is it that the U.S. wants to see a war in Lebanon? Who benefits if the country goes there?
Well, as was very apparent since 2006, apartheid Israel, the United States, and outside forces outside Lebanon cannot engage Hezbollah in a direct military confrontation. So it's been since that year that they have been searching for local actors to start a civil war. And as we heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's speech on Sunday, those who have the ability to start a civil war in Lebanon, and he was speaking about the Sunni leadership, some of the Sunni leadership, do not want a civil war. And those who want a civil war, like the Christian supremacist parties, they can't afford or cannot achieve a war. So therefore, what we have seen right now is there has been an economic war on Lebanon since 2019, and up until now, the goals that the United States set for this economic war, which is to instigate a revolt in the population against the presence of resistance groups in Lebanon, has not came to fruition. Most of the Lebanese people have absorbed all these shocks and awes of economic destabilization and have not revolted against Hezbollah and the resistance. And in fact, what Sayyid Nasrallah and Hezbollah have just done with this bringing and on the way this tanker with the oil products is making those who were standing on the fence jump to the side.
Immediately
of the
after Sayyid Nasrallah's speech, there was a phone call between U.S. Ambassador Dorothy Shea and the Lebanese President Michel Aoun. And Dorothy informed him, look at the words, she informed him that the U.S. administration wants to help Lebanon extract power, electricity from Jordan through Syria. Mind you, that's the same Syria that the U.S. has imposed illegal Caesars Act against it. So anyone who deals with the Syrian government or with any Syrian company, that is, will be put under those sanctions and suffer. How on earth is Shia planning to do so? I mean, there is zero diplomacy between the U.S. and Damascus here, and the U.S. had already imposed Caesar's Act upon Syria. How are they going to make that happen?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, she is offering the moon and the sun the day after Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announces the ship on the way with these huge projects of connecting the electric grid from Jordan to Syria to Lebanon, connecting the gas pipelines from Egypt to Jordan to Syria to Lebanon. Again, huge projects that will take 6 months to a year. That is, if there is
and
any
that will
objections.
Cost millions and millions of dollars that Lebanon does not have.
Exactly, and she said that she's speaking to the IMF to fund this project. So,
oh, thank you. More debt, yes, please.
Exactly, and what's funny about it, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in his speech on Sunday pointed out, is that this shows that there was governments, because this project has been talked about for years, Jordan and Egypt, that were willing to help Lebanon, but the United States has been vetoing such a project. So what needs to happen is that the United States lifts its veto on cooperation between countries in the region and allow the Lebanese economy to integrate with the countries around it, which it should be. And the only obstacle in the way is American interference and veto. So Ambassador Shea basically exposed herself by saying that she's willing to do this project.
Mm-hmm. And, well, look, like we will talk more about this in the second segment and talk more about how this Iranian ship will be an actual lifeline for all Lebanese people after this break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
It became necessary for the U.S. to make Hezbollah pay the price of the strategic role it had played in preventing the fall of Syria and striking the strategic structure of the Takfiri groups in Iraq as well. Added to that, Hezbollah's extended hand to the Yemeni brothers, who are facing a colonial legacy that is more than 100 years old. Above all, Hezbollah's role in uniting the resistance forces in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Now, today, the Americans, along with France, Britain, and Germany, in cooperation with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, are using their old Lebanese tricks, which are political parties, feudal leaders, religious leaders, and academic institutions, and the new ones, civil activism institutions and NGOs, in an effort to attain one goal, implementing the strategy of tension with maximum pressure against Hezbollah and therefore against Lebanon. Iranian fuel lifeline for Lebanon in this following report.
"They will just get used to it," is a phrase attributed to Central Bank Governor Riyad Salemi commenting on the Lebanese people's dealing with the collapse of the value of their lira has sadly become the constitution of the majority of the power forces in Lebanon. 2 years ago, Lebanon went through three major economic shocks. The shock of the bankruptcy of the banking sector, which is reluctant to declare its bankruptcy, the shock of the collapse of the Lebanese lira and then lifting subsidies, and the shock of the power and fuel outages across the country. Each of these shocks is enough on its own to destroy an economy, even if it is a strong one, and to destroy the population's livelihood capabilities. The lifting of subsidies cannot take place, even in the most brutal capitalist systems, without a social safety net. Even the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and other institutions of the capital system in the world recommend that the decision to eliminate subsidies for basic commodities be simultaneous with social protection programs for the most vulnerable classes. Successive shocks that hit the population of Lebanon, coupled with the global pandemic of corona, the explosion of the port, and a continuous political crisis which produced irregularities in the constitutional institutions, like government vacuum, presidential vacuum, and parliamentary extension, that consumed more than half of the past 16 years. The reality is more like an undeclared war. In this regard, unconventional solutions must be found, foremost of which is securing energy sources in the face of monopoly and siege, and bypassing the complete impotence of institutions. Emergency procedures aimed at resuscitating the patient and preventing his death. Here lies the importance of importing oil from Iran. It is not a solution to the crisis in Lebanon, but it is certainly a lifeline in the face of the internal and external forces of death. Importing oil from Iran is neither a challenge nor an internal competition. Rather, it provides oxygen to Lebanon at a moment when many wants it to be completely strangled. Lebanon has many emergency options which the authority could have resorted to mitigate the severity of the collapse, in parallel with working on a reform plan that would halt the collapse and rebuild the system in an effective manner. Common sense says that the state should arm itself with the decision of the resistance and rely on it to impose alternative economic options that support the living capabilities of the population. However, the reaction of Washington and those in its orbit indicate a confrontation that they want the people to pay to push them back from their pro-resistance stance. Opening a fuel lifeline from Tehran to Beirut to import gasoline and diesel will produce effects that will mitigate the consequences of the crisis. Even if it does not constitute a comprehensive solution to it, it is the first attempt in Lebanese history to break the power of cartels and greedy importers, as well as a first break of the American decision to increase pressure on Lebanon.
Now we continue from Beirut with Laith Maruf, political commentator and senior media consultant. Laith, the United States decided to fight all battles to prevent Hezbollah's plans to lift its people, and with it the entire country, by the way, from the grip of all sorts of cartels, notably the fuel cartels and the pharmaceutical cartels, including preventing oil support from Tehran to reach Lebanon. whether it is by sea, by land, by any means. They just don't want to see that help coming to the Lebanese people. What do you think will happen if Shia actually succeeds in pushing the Lebanese government into banning the Iranian ship from entering Lebanese waters?
Look, it is a very big if, because as we have seen, the major parties that are in power in Lebanon that are allied with Hezbollah, that control a majority in the parliament, control the president's office, are actually welcoming the arrival of this tanker. So what we would, the only way that this could happen is if there's a coup by the military, the Lebanese army, against the president and the parliament and against Hezbollah.
It's very dangerous.
And that's very dangerous. And we know that the United States has been pushing towards this confrontation between the military of Lebanon and Hezbollah, and they haven't had the success yet. And I doubt that even if General Aoun, in charge of the military, decides to follow the dictates of the United States, I doubt his soldiers will follow him. And that's because the actual composition of the Lebanese army is a reflection of the population of Lebanon, and that means that the majority of his own soldiers will refuse him. So this is a big if, and sanctions might be waived as a weapon against everybody in this country, and this is the last weapon that's left at the table of the United States to sanction the politicians of Lebanon as a whole, the whole government. And that will just drop everybody in the resistance basket, basically, and nobody will be affected by anything beyond that, any control of the United States. So it's a double-edged sword for the United States to threaten, number one, that the military take on Hezbollah and this tanker coming from Iran, and or to sanction the whole political elite in Lebanon, because then it will have zero influence over that situation on the ground.
Well, we have all these anti-resistance parties, like the regimes and governments all across the region and the world as well, working according to one theory, that the defeat of Hezbollah now requires two things. One, to disband its allies, that's through sanctions, whatever the cost is, and then create tensions resulting from the living crisis that Lebanon is passing through, wherever they are and at whatever the cost as well. Tension is very easy to create in a country like Lebanon. We could just start a fight right now at the gas station outside this studio where people are gathering to try and get gasoline. But what will the U.S. be able, or how will the U.S. be able to disband Hezbollah's main allies in Lebanon? And if so, do you think that maybe the first party to fall from this alliance would be which one here? Do you have one in mind?
I personally think that the parties that are aligned with Hezbollah have taken a decision to be loyal, and Hezbollah has shown its loyalty no matter how much under pressure it came, because Hezbollah is the only party that has no corruption at all that anybody can point at. Right now, the biggest worry that we should look at here is not that some people will have a fight at a gas station or outside a bakery. The problem that we should be all worried about is the entry of an external power into the battle here. And this is, we look at the last 15 years, and we know that the major players that could have a civil war with Hezbollah are not capable of doing such. Therefore, the only thing that we should be worried about is the possibility of an external war.
Well, evident to your words here, Leith, just last week there was a trending on social media in Lebanon where a lot of the anti-resistance people who maybe support the Lebanese forces, the Jaja, political affiliated forces, they were calling through social media for the intervention of the NATO and foreign forces to rid them from what they are calling the Iranian occupation. This is beyond what one can believe, but it did happen. So you can actually feel how much of the investments of the U.S. embassy are taking their toll on the Lebanese society. Yes, they were not that high. I mean, you could study the trends in Lebanon, but at the same time, it was being used in English language, and they all were using specific words like immediate intervention, like Iranian occupation, like rid us from terrorism, for example. So what do you make out of all of this?
They're talking to their white master. And this is actually shows you how weak they are.
I love your terminology.
It shows you how weak they are. They can't talk to the Lebanese population and such. This propaganda doesn't work anymore. And they're addressing their master. And the funny part is that this is happening during the American defeat, withdrawal from Afghanistan.
True.
With those historic images that we saw. And so, you know, they can bark, but their master is not going to come to help them because they will not risk something worse than Afghanistan.
Well, they were actually beaten up word-wise, verbally, by the American ambassador who reprimanded her NGO representatives as a result of the utter failure of the August 4th and the August 4th plan for Lebanon. And she reiterated her request to focus on the danger of Hezbollah. These are talking points coming out of the meeting that she had. I'm not making this up. You can find it in Lebanese media. Unfortunately, we may witness many events that reflect this American understanding of chaos, such as bloody confrontations in more than one Lebanese region, especially regions where it's mixed with different sects, or maybe motorized media campaigns, or even judicial procedures, in addition to great pressures to prevent Lebanon from obtaining any kind of direct or indirect support unless it is controlled by the West. In 1 minute, is Lebanon on the brink of war, or has the U.S. completely lost Lebanon?
Look, the response of the ambassador came after the speech on Friday when Sayyid Nasrallah announced the coming of the first ship. We've moved past that. So everything that she's done is useless now because already by Sunday, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announced the second ship on the way and also raised the stakes and said there is oil and gas in the waters, territorial waters of Lebanon, and if the international companies that the United States controls are not willing to extract, that they will bring Iranian companies to do so. So,
well, this has got to bring out media frenzy, and I'm just looking forward to what will happen during this week when the ship actually arrives on it. Thank you very much, Laith Maarouf, political commentator and senior media consultant, for being with us and discussing this. I will be willing to discuss this more with you when the frenzy touches a new level. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Muharram, times of sadness have.
As-salamu alayk ya Aba Abdullah.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue, a special program for the month of Muharram.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the grandson of the esteemed and honorable Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards salvation and prosperity, the one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura saying, in so many difficulties and sorrows, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances before you, O Allah. This is because I lean on you and I am inclined towards you. I tend towards no other. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words.
Oh.
Imam al-Husayn's words in a letter to the inhabitants of Basra.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام أما بعد فإن الله اصطفى محمدا صلى الله عليه وآله من خلقه وأكرمه بنبوته واختاره لرسالته ثم قبضه إليه وقد نصح لعباده وبلغ ما أرسل به وكنا أهله وأولياءه وأوصياءه وورثته وأحق الناس بمقامه في الناس فاستأثر علينا قومنا بذلك فرضينا وكرهنا الفرقة وأحببنا العافية ونحن أعلم أن أحق بذلك الحق المستحق علينا ممن تولى وقد بعثت رسولي إليكم بهذا الكتاب وأنا أدعوكم إلى كتاب الله وسنة نبيه فإن السنة قد أميتت والبدعة قد أحييت فإن تسمعوا قولي أهدكم إلى سبيل الرشاد والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Now Allah selected the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah bestow His grace unto him and his progeny. Allah selected the Prophet Muhammad from among the people and honored him with His prophethood and appointed him for His apostleship. And after he had done his prophetic duty well and directed the people to Allah, Allah took him to Himself, made him pass away. And we have been his family members, associates, vicegerents, and heirs, and we have been the most rightful of the people to attain the Prophet's post. However, some people usurped this right from us, but we gave consent, for we disliked division and favored public welfare. And we know that we are indeed more deserving over this right than those who have gained it. I have already dispatched my envoy to you with this letter and invite you to the Book of Allah and His Prophet's way. For the Sunnah has diminished and heresy has been restored. Hence, if you listen to me, I shall direct you to the path of felicity, and may salam be unto you, and the mercy and grace of Allah be with you all.
Karbala, as I step onto your sands, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath your skies.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. Assalamu alayki ya Aba Abdullah. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam received many letters from the people, the Muslims of Basra, Kufa, and other places. In answer to the people of Basra, who had written a letter of request to him, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it that the main standards of the Islamic religion should be asserted over there. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, first of all, stressed on the prophethood of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was the topmost selection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the guidance of all people, and that the Prophet Muhammad did his best, spared no efforts, in order to guide the people to the right path. And then Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicated that he had dispatched one of his confident couriers to the people of al-Basra in southern Iraq. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicated that the conduct of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam had already been forsaken, and that the Jahiliyyah standards had long been revived, and indicated that he wanted to direct the people and in fact the Muslim world to the right path. He indicated it that it was the right or the path of felicity, Sabil al-Rashad, the path of felicity. Please note well that, I mean, here felicity is of much more importance and significance compared with the path of victory. It indicates that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam intended to take the whole Muslim people to felicity, not to save his own life or the lives of his own and his close relatives. It indicates that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam intended to convey to people that when it comes to the fate of the Islamic religion and the fate of the Muslim people and the Muslim Ummah, it takes precedence over any personal benefit. And at the same time, we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in order to reach this conclusion, made a premise, and the premise was based on the standards of prophethood, imamate, and the significance of the divine decision to dispatch prophets. So we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's movement was again in the line of all great prophets of the world. Sallallahu alayhi ya Aba Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always. عليك مني
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Panahian. Please stay tuned.
آخر فطرت بله زیباست. حسین علیه السلام نقشش چیه در این وسط؟
Human innate fitra is beautiful. What is the role of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam in flourishing our fitra? The Holy Prophet stated, indeed, there is a heat in the believer's heart which never cools down. Imam al-Sada also narrates that one day Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam was sitting in a place when Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, who was a little child, came in. The Prophet hugged him and kept him by chest. Also, it is narrated by Ibn Abbas that Prophet Muhammad always shed tears upon visiting the face of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Once, when Prophet Muhammad hugged Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he said a sentence which shows why our innate fitra is connected to Abu Abdullah al-Husayn.
Karbala, as I step onto your sands, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath your skies.
فرمودن برای قتل حسین یه حرارتی در قلب مؤمن.
Prophet Muhammad stated, indeed, there's a heat in the believer's heart which never cools down. These words are related to our innate fitra without directly mentioning the word fitra. Innate passion makes a fire within us. Now, the love and passion for Imam al-Husayn is a unique divine opportunity. Allah has made one part of our innate fitra to flourish with the heat of the martyrdom of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. This is something related to our fitra and a natural phenomenon.
Amr fitriye.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura, always full of mysteries. Ashura, always full of mysteries.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Panahian. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care, and Assalamu alaik, Ya Aba Abdullah al-Husayn.
Beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there? Ashura, Al-Husayn was murdered here. Ashura. Al-Husayn.
میگه پیپل.
Housing crisis in America.
The U.S. is facing a decade-long housing shortage. The government will have to build homes for dozens of years to tackle this issue. Home prices in almost every U.S. state have been on the rise over the past year with no end in sight.
Currently in the United States, we have a huge shortage of housing. We're not producing nearly as much housing as we should be.
We know that home ownership is the primary way of getting into the middle class, but unfortunately, there are many impediments to that that are divided by class and particularly race.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Aria. Now, as the Delta variant of the coronavirus spreads fast across America, people are still suffering to meet the basic needs of their families, including a place to stay. Tenants are naturally the most vulnerable in dealing with evictions. In this episode, we will delve into the housing crisis in America and how more painful it's become throughout this pandemic. Stay with us.
If you're looking to buy a home, the best thing you can do from a flood perspective is know what your current risk is from the current environment and then how that will evolve over the next 30 years. And flood risk isn't a static one-time thing that you need to look at. It is an ever-evolving risk that continues to grow in some parts of the country at an exponential rate.
The economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic has hit America hard, with many people losing their jobs, particularly in the fast food industry, airlines, hotels, restaurants, and the service sector. Low-income families are struggling to make ends meet. Affordable housing is a key issue. The plight of tenants has escalated into a legal and political row about evictions.
You know, there are so many rental property owners, housing providers, who are independent rental owners. They're not large corporations. And when they don't receive rent, they still have to find a way to pay their mortgage for the property, to pay the water, the lights, to pay the insurance. There's been no relief for them on that particular front. And I can tell you some of our own stories. And in my company in Southern California, we do manage for independent rental owners. I have one client who owns 5 rental units. She has one renter who hasn't paid rent since April of last year and is now delinquent to the tune of $21,000.
The idea was that landlords are not allowed to evict their tenants throughout this pandemic, which has caused serious economic hurdles for many inside the United States. Our first guest today is economist Marcia Baker. Welcome to the show, madam. First off, what challenges is the nation facing today, which emanate from the overarching issue of housing in America?
Americans have a housing challenge alongside a challenge of unreliable electricity, a very difficult transportation, food access, healthcare access, and with housing, there are 580,000 homeless by official count. And beyond that, the U.S. has the highest rate ever in the number of people per household. The old are staying with their younger children. You have 3 and 4 generations crammed together. So you have a crisis of living conditions and people being very upset and worried because they're one day from being out on the street. So the drug addiction problem, alcoholism problem, it all goes together in the housing crisis in the U.S. today.
Facing a deadly global pandemic, low-income families are finding it increasingly difficult to make ends meet. Struggling tenants are facing the threat of eviction from their landlords. Meanwhile, home builders and apartment associations have spent millions of dollars on lobbying for an end to the moratorium on rental evictions. As the ban expired on 31st of July, President Joe Biden reportedly froze housing lobbyists out of discussions with the White House, and he asked the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, to issue a renewed ban on evictions of tenants. The 60-day ban was duly issued.
Are you sure it's going to pass Supreme Court muster?
There are several key scholars who think that it may, and it's worth the effort.
His argument is that even if this move is ultimately blocked by the courts, at the very least, it will buy states time to distribute tens of billions of dollars in federal rent forgiveness to help make renters whole and keep them from being kicked out of their homes.
Yet, the fight over whether landlords should be allowed to evict their cash-strapped tenants has to be resolved in American courts. We're now joined by journalist Mike Harris for his insight into the matter.
Well, my pleasure.
Now, Mike, how come housing is still a problem in America today, considering the fact that the U.S. is spending huge amounts of money elsewhere in the world for military and intelligence purposes?
Well, one fundamental truth that the government of the United States has forgotten is that they are here to serve the people. And that truth has been lost. They're currently more involved with serving the special interest groups. Namely the military-industrial complex, the big banking cartels, those people who are trying to consolidate and expand the U.S. empire. In fact, our government has in many cases turned toxic against the people of the United States and is doing things that are really prosecuting the U.S., the citizens of the U.S., and damaging them in many ways.
A CDC ban on evictions by landlords was introduced specifically to address the situation in counties with high levels of COVID-19 transmission. But the ban soon turned into a subject for political wrangling among politicians, and landlords soon rushed to put an end to it through legal lobbying.
What I also understand is, what it's like to get an eviction notice?
Years ago, she lived out of her car while caring for a newborn and a toddler.
I know what it's like every single minute to not be able to sleep because you got two kids. You got to make sure that you keep safe.
It will be a win for people who have for such a long time, because I'm one of those people. That's why I ran for office. Felt like nobody listened.
The CDC measure was supposedly meant to protect tenants who state under a penalty of perjury that they are unable to pay rent and would face overcrowded conditions if evicted. The measure in part triggered a fierce debate about the federal government's authority to do so. What is the situation like today, and what should be done about it?
The immediate situation in August in the United States regarding housing is there is an extension of preventing throwing people out of their houses until October. The institutions of the United States, the courts, the Supreme Court, the presidency, has approved this, and this is a continuation of not evicting people that came in under President Trump during the pandemic in 2020. But there's no solution here. What is necessary is to freeze the rental agreements and the mortgage mortgage contracts and sort them all out.
The House Democrats initially rushed to reverse course amid a serious divide between progressive lawmakers and the housing lobbyists. But after a short time, some Democrats fell in line with the lobbyists, putting the fate of evictions hanging in the balance. As the power struggle continues, nearly 45 million tenants in the United States are facing growing concerns about how to resist evictions by their landlords.
$50 billion was allocated, $46 billion. Less than 10% of that has been spent. Around $3 billion is reported to me, but let's say it would be 10%. Why should the renters be punished for the fact that the system did not put money in their pockets to pay the rent to the landlords? So that's where we come to this. It's like, well, CDC, you have defined this, and these people have not gotten the money. So I think this is something that will work out. It isn't about any more money. The money is there, resting in localities and governor's offices across the country.
There are also more than half a million homeless people today, according to official estimates, who see no path to the right to have a home. The power play in Washington is indeed causing a great amount of human suffering as politicians continue partisanship in the hopes of gaining more control. So what role do you think that partisanship plays in the housing shortage and homelessness in America today?
The problem in America regarding leadership is we have conflicts between parties when above the parties, we have to have the right policies. And you have Wall Street and London heavily represented in both parties that want to continue to have a bailout, want to speculate in housing, speculate in unregulated electricity, and worse, they want crazy green policies. So the solution to the housing and the rest of the lack of production in the United States that's currently the condition is above parties.
For decades, powerful housing industry groups have been lobbying politicians on Capitol Hill to influence policy. Take the most powerful one, the 100-year-old National Association of Realtors, or NAR, which has spent nearly $700 million on lobbying politicians since 1998.
Hi, I'm Charlie Lee, Senior Counsel and Director of Legal Affairs at NAR. As buyers compete in a hot real estate market, they are searching for ways to stand out from the crowd. One method being used is to send a love letter to entice the seller into choosing their offer. While a love letter may seem innocent, they can raise fair housing concerns and risk exposing both the real estate broker and their clients to legal risks.
It is no surprise that since the pandemic began, the association has been at the forefront of the legal fight to end the moratorium on rental evictions. But the association is not alone and has the backing of the U.S. Supreme Court, which bolstered the legal case against the ban by giving the Biden administration just 3 days to end prohibition of evictions. The ban on evictions had been initially imposed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention last September.
The big firms like Vanguard and State Street and BlackRock have been buying real estate, residential real estate, at a prodigious rate and have been bidding up the prices. Well, they're going to crash those prices in conjunction with the eviction moratorium expiring. And so what this is going to do is going to have a catastrophic effect on all of real estate pricing. So real estate pricing in the U.S. is going to be cut 40, 50, 60, 70% in its current valuation. What this is going to do is the same situation they were in back in 2006, 7, and 8 when the mortgage crisis happened and people could not refinance. They could not sell their homes for what they owed on them. And they were forced into foreclosure again.
The totality of the row over evictions sheds light on the depth of divide within the U.S. political system, with the Supreme Court, the Biden administration, and the CDC fighting to take the right decision. The American people appear to be the actual victims of inaction by U.S. authorities. American officials have indeed failed to ease circumstances for many.
You know, the lawsuit that the Southern California Rental Housing Association has filed in federal court has been denied, and we immediately filed an appeal. One might wonder why we would file an appeal on some legislation that's due to expire, quite frankly, today. But what we're seeing is this overabundance of legislation against rental housing providers and this pitting of renters versus rental housing providers. And we want it to stop.
Now, Americans have until October 3rd for the latest CDC moratorium to expire. The buildup of tensions among the poor is getting out of control, whereas realtor lobbyists brutally advance their agenda to give more power to landlords, who are the people promoting the idea of a return to evictions. How are they benefiting from evictions, and what is their ultimate goal?
The people who are promoting this are the banking cartel, run by the five or six too-big-to-fail banks that were bailed out by the taxpayers in 2008. It's the same people. They're the ones who underwrite the loans. Those are the ones who make it possible. They're the ones who are going to benefit by taking possession of the wealth and property of the middle class. And what they're going to do is turn America from a home-owning society into a rental society, where the American dream of owning your own home will be gone. And they're doing this. This is part of their goal to asset strip. They're strip mining the American middle class and trying to steal all their wealth to remove what little wealth that the people of the United States currently enjoy.
Housing went on a historic run this year, despite the common assumption that it would sink in the wake of the economic recession caused by the coronavirus pandemic. But the housing market is seeing a major shift. As fewer properties are available in the market, the situation is triggering bidding wars across the country, and house prices are rising steadily.
There's a bidding war for literally every home on the market, every fixer-upper, every house that needs even a lot of work.
My neighbors, actually, because we were on vacation, were calling me and texting me saying, like, what is going on at your house? There's people in a line down the block. We saw two people having a fight.
Everybody expected housing to really sort of dry up.
The situation is convincing a significant portion of the population to immigrate, and one top destination would be across the Atlantic to Europe, according to statistics. Would-be home buyers are getting fed up by soaring prices and they're lost out in bidding wars.
The underlying problem in the United States with housing, and the same with other physical and soft infrastructure like schools or manufacturing plants, is the physical production of housing and of manufacturing has not been expanding. You have not had the housing units built that you need. And worse than that, you've had decades of speculation in pre-existing housing, and you have the Wall Street London factor coming in on the situation, making big profiteering off big mansions, while the ordinary worker families of the nation do not have adequate housing.
With prospects of owning a home becoming increasingly distant for many Americans, people are wondering where the housing market is headed to next. Many experts believe that house prices will continue to rise, and there is virtually no prospect of a significant fall in house prices in the near future. Meanwhile, homes are selling for up to 30% over asking price. Nationwide, houses are being sold for more than their original list price.
We know that that typically also requires having a certain amount of income. And for a lot of people, that is much easier said than done. For example, for people of color, it is much harder to be able to put down that type of down payment because they may not have the familiar support as people who come from more affluent neighborhoods.
These gaps are exceedingly troubling because the implications of them are very pervasive. Black household wealth is one-tenth what it is for white households, and a big, large portion of that gap is due to the lack of home ownership. Even though mortgage rates are at historic lows, there's been a ratcheting up of the qualifications that are required to borrow to become a homeowner, and that has impacted minority households more than majority households.
Of course, there is plenty of space and materials for building new homes. However, greater supply of new houses does not solve the problems of housing and homelessness in America, since these new homes remain unaffordable and out of reach for many.
You have to remember that 2006, 7, 8, when the Wall Street banking firms inflated the real estate bubble and intentionally burst it and dispossessed over 8 million households. And so that recovery has kind of happened. The people who were dispossessed still have not recovered fully. And so one of the reasons that we have such a homeless problem is because of that, because people lost everything. So you have a middle class that is struggling to hang on to what little it has left. And now we have our current crisis, this COVID issue.
The housing crisis, of course, was not caused by the pandemic, but only exacerbated by it. Back in 2018, the official statistics of the federal government showed some 35% of the people could be unsheltered across the states. People had no idea a global pandemic was about to break out.
The codes basically say if you have this kind of function going on within a building, in this kind of building, you can use these standards in order to meet our level of safety, sanitation, etc.
When you build in an area, one of the first things you do is you acquaint yourself with the exact code requirements that will affect the development and building process at that specific site. Then the specifics you also check against the code as you go.
Though we at FEMA